States v. Guardado. Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey and members of the court. I'm still Robert Felber, and I still represent Master Sergeant Alan Guardado. I say still to the members of this court to emphasize the prejudice which the unlawful conduct of DFS officials has caused to my client in denying him pay and denying it to him for this extended period of time. My client was punished in violation of Article 13 Uniform Code of Military Justice by the unlawful withholding of his pay because this was withholding of pay furthered no legitimate government interest. Now, the DFS decision to disobey the clear directive of this honorable court in Howell v. United States was not reasonable and furthered no legitimate non-punitive objective. It instead was based upon the arbitrary decision of a mid-level DFAS attorney in defiance of this honorable court and represents the same sort of challenge to the authority of the military justice system with which this court dealt in United States v. Suzuki. In Suzuki, convening authority on the misadvice of a staff judge advocate determined that a military judge's ruling ordering credit against the sentence was unlawful and determined that he could unilaterally overrule the decision of a court.
Mr. Feldman, let's go back to your point about the reasonableness of part of DFAS. Now, DFAS has, your position is that they are bound to obey the findings or the decisions of this court.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, but by statute, they are in the business of claims, right?
Well, they're in the business of finance and accounting.
Right, and they have two courts above them, right? They have the Federal Claims Court, or the Court of Federal Claims, I should say, and then they have the Federal Circuit. So once the DFAS sees what those precedents are, why is it so unreasonable for them to abide by the precedents of the courts that normally supervise their activities?
Well, several things, Your Honor. First of all, the DFAS...
I mean, they're kind of in a if they're in the middle of a dispute, right?
Not exactly, Your Honor, and here's why.
First, well, I mean, the dispute being that DFAS hears from the CAF, hears from the Court of Claims, and it hears from the Federal Circuit. Why is it unreasonable for them to simply abide by the rulings of the courts that supervise them?
Well, several things, Your Honor. Number one, the DFAS opinion upon which this is based misidentifies the Court of Federal Claims as an Article III court. It's not. It's an Article I court, which by the terms of its own decisions do not create precedent and deal only with specific claimants and specific claims for cash.
But isn't on this specific issue, isn't DFAS relying on the Federal Circuit Court's rulings?
Well, Your Honor,
as well?
Several things about DOC. Number the first and most important.
You'd agree that the Federal Circuit is an Article III court.
Yes, Your Honor. And the decision on which DFAS is relying in DOC was issued before Ortiz, in which the United States Supreme Court said that this court has primacy in the interpretation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So it's therefore plainly erroneous to rely upon a decision from the Federal Circuit, which the Supreme Court said must defer to this court in the interpretation of the Uniform Code.
But in Howell, we didn't necessarily take that position. We suggested that, hey, look, this is a conflict between two court systems, and who is the one who can resolve this? And we said we thought it was the president, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the president did resolve it, didn't he?
What the president did is he put the words of the code into effect. What the president could not have done is said, you know what, we're going the opposite because this court already found that the words of the statute meant a certain thing. And the rules for court-martial can't contradict the code. They can implement it, but can't contradict the code, as this court has held many times. More to the point,
Counsel, in order for you to prevail on the credit claim, you don't need to prevail on this claim, do you? You don't need to prevail on the point that we can order DFAS to do anything or that DFAS has to do anything we say. You can still prevail on the credit.
Yes, Your Honor. This is not a Tucker Act claim. We're not demanding a specific performance of specific cash.
So why are we getting into what DFAS should have done and whether we can order DFAS to do something? Why are we not focusing on the credit claim?
Your Honor, I would focus this court on language in Combs in which the Federal Court of Claims recognized that, you know what, even if there is a lawful pay action, that may result in Article 13, an Article 13 violation, and only the military court system is competent to determine whether or not there has been a violation of Article 13.
And that's my point.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And that's without dispute. It is without dispute that this court system and this court system alone determines whether there has been unlawful pretrial punishment. And that is a related issue, but it's a distinct issue from whether or not, from the exact sum that my client should be paid by officials of the Defense Finance and Accounting.
Right, because in your brief, Mr. Feldmayer, you're actually not pursuing the punishment issue under Article 13, are you?
Well, we're pursuing the unreasonableness issue.
Right, you're saying that there is no legitimate governmental interest or objective in how DFAS resolve the issue in this case or any other case like it.
Correct, Your Honor. I mean, the reasonable action would have been if DFAS officials had some heartburn about this conflict to seek declaratory judgment, not just to unilaterally decide we're going with this and not.
Well, they didn't unilaterally decide. They had authority to make the decision that they made, didn't they?
Your Honor, I'm aware of no statutory authority.
No, that's statutory authority. They had the edicts from the two courts that we just talked about. So telling them that this is how this issue gets resolved.
Well, yes, Your Honor, with regard to the Court of Federal
Claims. They weren't disregarding anything.
With regard to the Court of Federal Claims Authority, that's not mandatory precedent. With regard to the Federal Circuit, that was before Ortiz.
All right.
Well, I'm not sure what Ortiz has to do with any of this, but go ahead.
Well, that the Federal Circuit had interpreted the Uniform Code of Military Justice, this court interpreted it in a different way, and in a conflict between the two, this court's interpretations must prevail because the Supreme Court recognized that the military justice system, and indeed Article 76 recognizes, that the decisions of this court are binding upon all officers of the United States, and this court ruled in a certain way, and that ruling is binding.
Within its jurisdiction.
And
within its jurisdiction, our jurisdiction as to matters of fiscal law is, I would venture to say, limited, but go ahead.
And this is not a demand for a specific cash payment. Rather, it is for credit under.
Right. You want sentence credit. You want it translated. You want the bucks translated into sentence credit.
Well, Your Honor, we would argue that the calculation which we've advanced in our brief is a starting point for Article 13 credit and is not the end all. This court has recognized that mathematical calculations can be useful, or rather the service courts have recognized that mathematical calculations can be useful, but it's not the end point. Because Article 13, unlike a Tucker Act claim, has two purposes. Number one, it's to make the appellant whole, and number two, it's to deter future government.
Okay. Doesn't it all turn on, though, whether the government had a malign purpose in doing what it did?
Your Honor, the government brief makes much of the point that DFAS acted in good faith. That's not the same thing as reasonable. Conduct can be unreasonable but still undertaken in good faith.
Are you saying that it's arbitrary and capricious in an administrative law sense?
I'm saying that it is unreasonable that when this court has ruled to instead of resorting back to the court system, same as in Suzuki, instead of resorting back to the courts to just pick and choose, well, we think that the court ruled illegally, therefore we're going to disregard its decision. That is illegal conduct, members of the court.
Other than Howell, do you have any other basis for saying that the action of DFAS was unreasonable?
Well, number one, that it relies upon precedent that isn't precedent, the Court of Federal Claims. Number two, the DOC doesn't exactly deal with.
Even if it's not precedent, isn't it persuasive authority?
Yes, and this court's decision is mandatory authority. So to say we're going to choose.
So is it your argument that we have authority over DFAS?
It's my argument that the Uniform Code of Military Justice makes the final decisions of this court binding upon all officials.
Why do you suppose that in a footnote in the in our Howell opinion, that we suggested that this was something that the president needed to resolve.
Well, I think that the court in that, and again, I far be it for me to speak for the honorable members of this court, but...
Go ahead and speak for us.
Yes, Your Honor. But I believe that the reason why, one of the reasons why the court inserted that footnote in the decision is because by having the president issue the rule for court-martial, it certainly saved a lot of litigation, and it saves people going to going back to the Court for Federal Claims, the Army Court, or the Army Board of Correction and Military Records, and saying, you know what, this is due to me. It gives clarity to the situation and resolves the dispute, but it wasn't necessary to make the government course of conduct unreasonable, because a mid-level government official can't just say, we're disregarding what a court has told us to do. That's the same thing that happened in Suzuki. It was unreasonable there, and it's unreasonable here. It might be undertaken in good faith, but it's not reasonable.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I ask you about the Howell opinion and the second prong of the government's actions did not further a legitimate non-governmental purpose or intent. What do we mean by a legitimate government interest? What is your understanding of that test? And I'm trying to see how that test was met in Howell but isn't met here.
Well, back then it wasn't clear that the government course of conduct was unlawful. The court told all officials of the United States, pursuant to Article 76, this is what the law is. We have interpreted the Uniform Code of Military Justice. This is what it says. And a mid-level DFAS attorney said, actually, court, no, you're wrong. That's not what it means. That's the fundamental difference. In the past, there was no mandatory authority which told officials of the Department of Defense what this provision of the Uniform Code of Military Justice means. Now there is.
But in Howell, couldn't we have just said, DFAS, you are bound by this ruling? Couldn't we have said that?
You could have, but in the...
But we didn't, though, right?
In terms of where the posture of Howell was, the DFAS conduct wasn't inherently unreasonable because there was not clarity. Here, there's clarity because this court has ruled.
Right, but when we issued Howell, we could have said, this is the state of the law now. DFAS, you are bound to our rulings. Do as we say.
Well, Your Honor, that would... again, because we're focusing here on Article 13, not whether my client is due a specific amount of money, we're not focused on whether or not...
So you're distinguishing your client's actual remedy from the remedy in Howell? He wanted the money. Your client didn't want the money. He wants the credit.
What I'm saying here is that the procedural process we're at now is that the failure to pay indisputably, at least from our perspective, resulted as a collateral consequence in an Article 13 violation. In the same way as this court doesn't deal with the collateral consequences in terms of pay of its rulings, for example, this court wouldn't get involved in what is the effect on a military pension as of a dishonorable discharge, a pay decision can also affect a collateral consequence with regard to Article 13.
What really changed between our decision in Keyes and our decision in Howell?
Well, in Keyes, the comment was dicta. Comment on pay was dicta.
I mean, we said something in Keyes. The Federal Circuit the Federal Circuit disagreed with us in Docs or Coombs or whichever one they wrote, right? And then we wrote Howell. I didn't write Howell, but said, you know, we still disagree with them, right? So what's really different?
Well,
and we recognized in Howell that, look, DFAS has its job is to figure out how much someone's going to be paid. And it wasn't unreasonable for them to refer to the Federal Circuit's rule as opposed to what we thought in Keyes.
Well, back in Keyes, that as both the Federal
Circuit... I realize it was a slightly different posture, but, I mean, nothing changed about our view of the rule, the statute.
Except that in Keyes, the rule was put forth in dicta, Your Honor. Howell... It was the indisputable ruling of this court.
Let's go back to what the standard is. Again, it does not have a legitimate governmental objective, which would, you would argue that the way they conducted themselves, DFAS, and not giving in, so to speak, they were illegitimate, right? They made an illegitimate decision.
That legitimate conduct must be lawful conduct, Your Honor. And here it was unlawful conduct because it was in violation of the ruling of this court. If there's some dispute, that's what declaratory judgment is for. It's not we just pick and choose which one we want. I see I'm out of time.
But you would be asking them to thumb their nose at the Federal Circuit.
I'd be asking them to litigate the matter, Your Honor, not just pick and choose.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The judge found here, as I understand, that the government did not intend to punish him when it paid him what it paid him. And the judge found that doing that furthered a legitimate government objective, namely paying him correctly, at least in someone's opinion. So what do we got here?
Well, Your Honor,
if the government is sinless, where do we go?
Your Honor,
answer the question.
Your Honor, that ruling is plainly erroneous. Number one, because the conduct.
Okay, well, I mean, you can say it's plainly erroneous, and that's your answer.
Well, number two, Your Honor, because the military judge in part based his ruling on the fact that, well, if he's receiving less money but he has a place, and this is the judge's rule language from the judge's ruling, if he's receiving less money but has a place to live and something to eat, there's no prejudice. Wow. That's plainly erroneous. And one of the reasons why...
Three hots and a cot.
What's that, Your Honor?
Three hots and a cot.
Possibly, Your Honor. But one of the reasons why on rebuttal I will get to the need for a new Article 66 review is because the prejudice is continuing. And if my client were given a new Article 66 review, he'd be able to establish, for example, that he had to declare personal bankruptcy because he was not being paid in accordance with...
That's not before us.
Let me ask you this other question, Ms. Feldmeyer. Not that it has any relevance to our decision or your pursuit of your issue, but why can't your client go seek relief in the Federal Court of Federal Claims?
Well, he does have to exhaust military remedies before he can go to the federal claim.
Mm-hmm. But he can eventually, right?
He could eventually, yes, Your Honor.
So he's not without a remedy?
He's not without a remedy for the Tucker Act specific cash payment.
Mm-hmm.
However, that doesn't deal with the Article 13 issue, whether or not he's been punished prior to trial. And as the Court of Federal Claims has recognized in Combs, it doesn't deal with Article 13.
I understand.
May I ask just one last question?
Yeah. Judge Mayer.
At the end of the government's brief in a footnote, they say that even if your client prevails, he should only receive day-for-day credit because that's all he requested from the military judge. Could you respond to that?
Your Honor, the government appears to be relying upon some version of the law of the case doctrine, which doesn't apply here because the law of the case doctrine is when both parties and the military judge agree that this is the appropriate remedy and this is the law that should apply. Here the prejudice has continued to this day because my client still hasn't received the pay due to him, where at the time of trial, day for day may have fixed the problem. Now it doesn't because of the length of time and the continuing nature of the due process violation that continues to exist because he still hasn't received the correct amount of pay in consequence of the DFAS decision to defy this court. And
the question, if I ask a question? So let's assume that we give him Article 13 day-for-day credit. What does that do to his Tucker Act claim?
In Combs, the Federal Court of Claims considered the Court of Federal Claims recognized that if this court awards Article 13 credit, he gets that payment, and that is not in dispute before any court or by DFAS. That if this court awards day-for-day credit or any credit, DFAS goes ahead, and if DFAS doesn't, the Court of Federal Claims will make DFAS go ahead and pay in accordance with the Department of Defense Financial Management Regulation.
Well, does it extinguish the other claim?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Well, maybe not as a matter of arithmetic. or where are we on? I'm just, this is a follow-up on Judge Ryan's question. If he gets credit and he gets a certain amount of money, qua credit, does that extinguish whatever claim he has elsewhere?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. Again, because
Article because of arithmetic or why?
Not just because of arithmetic, because Article 13 credit is directed at a different issue. It's not satisfying a claim he has against the United States government.
Right, but it's got to be translated into money because that's all they've got.
Yeah, Your Honor, this court can grant relief under Article 13 that doesn't involve money. This court can set aside charges or specifications. This court is not bound by day-for-day credit or by a credit of days.
Okay, we could be more generous.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And you should be.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Stuckey, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Allison Rowley, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Wayne Williams, represent the government in this case. This court should find that appellant is not entitled to Article 13 credit because the military judge's finding that DFAS's pay determination was not made with the intent to punish and was in furtherance of a legitimate, non-punitive governmental interest was not clearly erroneous.
What would you say the legitimate governmental interest is?
Your Honor, in this case, the legitimate governmental interest is paying appellant in accordance with the proper pay entitlement as prescribed by Congress. And here, DFAS legal counsel made a good faith legal determination, acknowledging Howell, taking it into consideration, but acknowledging that even in light of Howell, there was no affirmative authority for them to pay appellant at the E-1 rate. This good faith determination was backed by the statutory and competent judicial authority through the Court of Federal Claims and the Federal Circuit that there is no fiscal authority to pay appellant at the E-1 rate.
But under Fisher, we're talking about not just punitive intent, but punitive effect. In terms of a reduction in pay from E-8 to an E-1, how is that anything other than punitive? It's based on criminal conduct.
Your Honor, in Howell, this court noted that the focus in the Article 13 analysis was not the punitive effect and whether or not there's a punitive intent. And in determining whether there's a punitive intent, we need to look at whether there's a legitimate government
now,
interest.
You're not saying that Howell overturned Fisher. Fisher says punitive intent or punitive effect. You're not saying that Howell overturned Fisher on that point, are you?
Your Honor, my reading of Howell is that to the extent that Fisher suggested the test for Article 13, whether or not there's a punitive effect, is that that is not the correct test for Article 13.
Well, Chief Judge Stuckey, with his separate opinion, didn't weigh in on that point. So how do you get three judges saying?
In Howell, Your Honor?
Yes.
Chief Judge Stuckey didn't.
So that's my point. How counting heads do you have three judges of this court in Howell saying that Fisher was incorrect in regard to looking not just on at punitive intent, but also punitive effect?
Your Honor, to your Honor's point, in looking at Fisher, Fisher didn't definitively determine that punitive effect was the test. It said, even if we were to consider punitive effect. And in this case, the military judge noted, he did note that under Fisher, it appeared that appellant had provided no evidence that there was, in fact, a punitive effect on him, in that the government provided him housing and subsistence. Turning to whether or not there was a legitimate governmental interest in this case, certainly the legitimacy of the governmental interest would be undermined if that pay determination were unreasonable or contrary to controlling fiscal law, but that is simply not the case here. The DFAS's interpretation of Article 75 is not inherently unreasonable. And this court acknowledged that in Howell. It explicitly said that the interpretation of Article 75.
On that specific point, Mr. Feldmayer said, well, it wasn't unreasonable in Howell because Howell hadn't yet been decided. But once we decided in Howell, then it no longer is reasonable that the idea that you're restored to full pay once your sentence is vacated is an interpretation of the UCMJ, and only this court can interpret the UCMJ. And once Howell reached a holding on that particular point, that there's no legitimate government interest. I mean, maybe it was ambiguous before, but it's not ambiguous now.
Your Honor, this court's interpretation of Article 75 in Howell was not new. This interpretation was also noted in Keyes. And so this has been a longstanding history of different interpretations between military courts and the Court of Federal Claims and the Court for the Federal Circuit.
Do you agree that all the previous statements, though, were dicta?
In what case, Your Honor?
Keyes.
Keyes, to the extent that the court in Howell explicitly relied on the statement in Keyes that Article 75 does not provide for the withholding at the original rate, although it was not central to the court's holding, it was a very strong statement that I think.
So I'm not sure how you're getting past the following statement in Howell. If an accused is released from confinement awaiting rehearing, his pay status, at least insofar as the UCMJ is concerned, should be the same as if he had never been tried in the first instance. So that goes to the point I made with Mr. Feldmayer. What happened with DFAS and whether that was appropriate and whether they were supposed to follow us and whether we can order them to do anything is to the side. The issue under Howell is, insofar as UCMJ purposes are concerned, this E8 should have been paid as an E8, not as an E1. Our remedy, the court's remedy, would be through credit, not through payment. So why should we not be looking at that credit issue?
Your Honor, I think because that, the simple finding that merely because a DFAS took an action contrary to this court's interpretation of Article 75 would essentially negate the whole entire test of Article 13 as to whether there's punitive intent or legitimate non-punitive non-governmental interest. And certainly this court's notation and interpretation of Article 75 is important because it could initially determine give a reason to infer impunitive intent.
Can you point to any reason why DFAS would have reduced the pay from E8 to E1 that wasn't based on the fact that he had a prior conviction and therefore it was punitive in nature?
Your Honor, no, but DFAS's determination was reliant upon the binding decisions of the Court of Federal Claims in the Federal Circuit, Doc and Combs.
But we're going in a circular way here. My point is, setting aside that, we're looking at, we said in Howell, we're the ones who protect the UCMJ interests here. This was punitive because the only reason they reduced from E8 to E1 was that prior overturned conviction. So why does this court not have the ability to order some credit be granted to this individual? Not that we should grant it. An argument can certainly be made that it should be returned below to have that figured out. But I'm talking about having that arrow in our quiver to ensure that credit is granted.
Certainly, if I'm understanding your question correctly, Honor, it is well within this court's jurisdiction to determine whether or not there's an Article 13 violation here and certainly grant relief if there is a violation. But in understanding and determining whether there is a violation in this case, it's important to note that DFAS's hands were essentially tied by the Court of Federal Claims and the Federal Circuit because those entities, Congress has statutorily determined that those entities are the courts that determine and litigate pay issues.
So what if anything, do we make of the President's amendment to Rule for Court-Martial 1208B and the fact that he made it prospective as opposed to immediate?
Your Honor, I think that...
I mean, it was one of the considerations for the military judge's determination not to award Article 13 credit, which is that we essentially said, hey, President, resolve the difference, and he did, but he didn't make it effective until January of 2019.
Yeah, yes, Your Honor, and I think DFAS legal counsel certainly acknowledged that and acknowledged that once the law changed, that that would essentially change the landscape of fiscal law, and they would be bound by that determination to then pay an appellant in this appellant's position at the original rate. But until and unless that law came into effect, there was simply no affirmative authority for DFAS to pay appellant at the E1 rate. And Your Honor raised a good point that this court in Howell in no way appeared to settle this debate. It noted that there is a legitimate debate, and it asked Congress and it asked the President to resolve that debate. And Congress and the President did. But until that law is in effect, it is simply it is reasonable for DFAS to follow the binding fiscal law as determined by the Court of Federal Claims and the Court of Federal Circuit. Any further questions?
Counsel, may I ask you to respond to Mr. Feldmeyer's answer to my question about if we were to find that there was an Article 13 violation, what the appropriate remedy would be? You say in your brief it would be day-for-day credit because that's what appellant asked for at trial, but Mr. Feldmeyer said, well, that would have been the appropriate remedy then, but the hardship continued, and so the remedy would have to be greater. What's the government's response to that answer?
Your Honor, I think that to the extent that appellant raised this at trial and determined that at trial that the remedy was day-for-day credit, that should be determined of this issue. And I would note that right now appellant is asking for 7 months credit, and I believe that way that was calculated was determining the amount of pay that was owed and working out how much confinement credit that would be equal to. And I think that in fashioning a remedy that essentially equates what money was owed to confinement credit could circumvent congressional intent that determinations of pay and entitlement to pay are to be resolved by the Court of Federal Claims and the Court for the Federal Circuit. And to the extent that appellant seeks a remedy for back pay, that should be litigated in the Court for the Federal Circuit and in the CFC.
Well, that's the whole problem, isn't it? We have no way of giving him back the time or the prestige. All we can do is give him money, or all the government can do. Let me be broad. All the government can do is give him money. And you have to translate something that's basically not translatable other than on a basis of day-to-day credit into money. So
I'm a little
go ahead.
Question based on Judge Stuckey's, Chief Judge Stuckey's question. Was appellant wearing the uniform and afforded the prestige of an E, whatever he was? Or was
eight,
he,
I think.
Or was he wearing the rank insignia of an E1?
I believe from, if I can recall the record correctly, he was wearing the rank of E8, Your Honor.
So he just wasn't being paid.
That's correct, Your Honor. And this court should find that that was not a violation of Article 13 in light of DFAS's good faith and legitimate belief that it was bound not by this court's interpretation of Article 75, but that by the courts in which Congress has vested authority to determine pay claims, the Court for the Federal Circuit and the Court for Federal Claims. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Mr. Feldmeyer, I hate to assault you before you get to the podium there, but when reading through your brief, I understood you to be arguing that you're not pursuing the punitive intent part of an Article 13 claim, right?
Yes, sir.
But let me ask you, the second prong in determining whether or not there's an Article 13 credit for legitimate governmental objective, is that the same as a punitive intent? I understood you to be not veering down that road at all, that you were solely and if you are, please tell me, but if you were solely focused on the fact that there's been an illegitimate and unreasonable decision on the part of DFAS, and therefore credit should be given in the case, or should have been given in the case.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not arguing that Mrs. Riley, DFAS General Counsel, I'm not climbing inside her head and saying she wanted to punish Master Sergeant.
No, I understand that. But as to Judge Olson's question about a punitive intent, or I'm sorry, a punitive effect, I didn't see in your brief where you were arguing that this is a punitive effect. You're simply saying this is simply in violation of the way Article 13 has and should be interpreted with regard to a legitimate governmental objective.
Well, Your Honor, I think part of arguing that it's not a legitimate government objective is to argue that there is punitive effect. A legitimate government objective
so
is
you,
not...
You've been convinced here today by Judge Olson.
Well, Your Honor, I think it goes without. I think it goes without. Without, of course, I.
Well, you could have said
just
that.
Just say yes.
Yes, sir.
You could have.
Your Honor is completely correct.
You could have said, "I agree with Judge Olson in your brief," because didn't he write in an opinion in how?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well,
yes.
How come you didn't say that?
Your Honor, lessons learned. Your Honor,
Mr. Fellmeyer, why should if. Underscore if we were to decide that credit is due, why should we be calculating this? Why should we not be sending this down?
Your Honor, part of what I've maintained, part of what we've maintained is that a new Article 66 review is due, not only because the Army Court operated under a apparently incorrect view of the law when it didn't in determining whether there'd be a due process violation, consider at all whether the Howell violation here was part of that, but didn't consider the cumulative effect. As we've raised below at the Army Court and as we raised here in our brief, there was post-trial delay of nearly a year. In consequence of that post-trial delay, my client sat in confinement a year longer than he needed to. Had the appropriate post-trial timeline processing timeline...
So I assume from all this you're saying it should be sent down.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I just wanted to touch... The government has conceded that there was punitive intent or punitive effect by...
I don't think they've conceded either one of those.
Nor do I.
Your Honor, the government indicated that there was no reason why he would have been paid as an E-1 but for the set-aside sentence, and that that was a punitive effect.
I did not hear them say that.
Your Honor, that was in response to the question before, but... That notwithstanding, members of the court, I want to focus also on the reasonableness of the DFAS decision.
Did they have the benefit of the Ortiz case?
Did DFAS? Yes, it was before the time of the Riley memorandum, Your Honor. The DFAS memorandum explaining why the DFAS would disregard Howell. They definitely had the benefit. This was an attorney writing it. They definitely had the benefit of that case, Your Honor. I'd also like to focus the court on the fact that, once again, decisions from the Court of Federal Claims do not create precedent. They are persuasive, not mandatory. And
does that apply to us, too?
It applies to everybody, Your Honor.
Damn.
And that Doc was a decision that didn't deal with the same set of circumstances. In Doc, the claimant in that case, his term of enlistment had expired, and the Federal Circuit was dealing with a situation where does somebody whose term of enlistment has expired, does he need to continue to be paid? So there was mandatory, there was perhaps authority that DFAS would say we have to follow for that situation, but there was no Federal Circuit case dealing with the type of situation here where an appellant was still subject to a valid term of enlistment, in fact, pending retirement, and was not in the same situation as the Doc claimant. My time has expired. If there are further questions,
thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. The court thanks counsel for both sides. Case is now submitted, and the court stands in recess pending further order of the court.